This past weekend, as protests against racial injustice continued across the country, the movement also made its way onto a street that's familiar to kids everywhere.
They look upset. Are the protesters sad?
They are sad and upset, and they have every right to be, Elmo. People are upset because racism is a huge problem in our country.
Racism? What's that?
That was Elmo talking with his dad as part of a Sesame Street special broadcast on CNN. But while Elmo's dad was comfortable addressing racism with his child, many parents in the United States are not. A 2019 study from Sesame Workshop surveyed parents of kids ages 3 through 12 and found that only around 10% talked frequently with their children about race. White parents were more than 3 times less likely than Black parents to say they brought up race often with their kids. So today, while more white parents might finally want to have these conversations with their children, they don't necessarily know where to start. So we have 2 guests who have thought a lot about teaching kids about race. Jessica Bratt is the Youth Services Manager at Grand Rapids Public Library in Michigan. Jessica, thanks for being on The Takeaway.
Thanks for having me.
Also with us is Bridget Vitrup, Professor of Childhood Development at Texas Women's University. Bridget, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Great to be here.
So, Bridget, we just heard that white parents talk to their kids about race at a rate much lower than Black parents. Why?
So a lot of white adults have grown up not being used to talking about it. Ever since the end of the civil rights movement, there's been this ideology of colorblindness where we shouldn't see color, we shouldn't talk about it, because that way, hopefully, we won't discriminate against people. The problem is that society is not colorblind. Children are not colorblind. But I think oftentimes part of the problem is that these parents are just not used to talking about it. And for white parents, a lot of parents I've talked to, they want their children to be colorblind. They're afraid that if they start talking about race, they're going to point out something that their children haven't seen or haven't noticed yet, or they assume their children have no biases. And also just being uncomfortable, not really knowing what to say, afraid of saying the wrong thing. There's a stereotype about white people being racist, so they're worried, what if I say the wrong thing? Somebody's going to think I'm racist. So there's a lot of factors that go into that.
I'm wondering, Bridget, also, we know that here in our country, oftentimes our social circles are very segregated, right? We may work with Black people and other people of color, but we don't necessarily spend our private time with them. Does that also have a role in the white parents in particular being uncomfortable talking about race? The fact that, you know, at home, there aren't other, their own social circles are not very diverse.
White people that live in mostly white neighborhoods and have gone to mostly white schools, because white is the majority race in the United States, it's a lot less salient. So you can be white and don't have to walk around every day being reminded of the fact that you're white. So it's not, it just isn't as present on people's minds. And neighborhoods today are actually more segregated than they were back around the time of Brown versus Board of Education. And because kids go to schools in the neighborhoods they live in, the schools are very segregated too.
Jessica, I'm curious, what are some of the questions that children tend to have for their parents about race?
A lot of kids are wondering from the very beginning, why does this person have a different color skin? I get a lot of kids who want to explore, why does this person have physical features? And for the older kids around 6 to 8, they may notice that this child speaks differently, or this child eats a different food that I'm not accustomed to. And so they have a lot of basic questions around cultural differences and physical differences. And a lot of times parents are afraid to engage in that.
And is that mainly because, again, they're not exposed to those differences in their daily lives? I would imagine if you're talking about kids in big cities, that there might be a little bit more exposure.
A lot of times parents assume that there's this osmosis effect that they can put their child in a diverse setting, and somehow in that setting, the kid will be open and they will have worked out any type of racial tension that may arise. They won't have any biases, conscious or unconscious, just by being around kids of color. Yet the studies and even talking with kids, that isn't true. They just make assumptions, a lot of times harmful assumptions. And depending on the trauma that the kid of color may go through when they're pointing it out and saying, well, why are you eating that weird food? Or why are you, you know, why is your skin like this? It perpetuates stereotypes all over again.
And Bridget, I'm wondering, does that fear and reluctance or just, you know, insecurity on the part of white parents hurt their children by not talking about race?
Yes, unfortunately, parents that try to take the colorblind perspective are well-intended. But the problem is that silence is a very big message, because kids are noticing all of these differences. And so if we don't talk about it, it's almost as saying, well, these people aren't important. It's not important to talk about. It's okay that we have all this social inequality, so we're just not going to address it. And what's interesting is that I did a study where we asked children actually about their parents' attitudes. These were all white children, asked them very simple questions about whether or not their parents liked black people. Would they be okay with you playing with a black friend? And quite a few kids either said flat out, no, I don't think they like black people, or they said, I don't know. Because if they, like you said, even if they might have black coworkers that they interact with at work, the kids don't see that. And so if they don't have friends of color coming over, then they never see their parents interact with them, and they don't have any conversations. So they may just assume that, well, I guess my parents don't like them, or they just don't know. And that can influence their development of racial biases.
Jessica, I'm curious about how this is playing out in this moment in particular, because I think we can ignore, if you will, and I'm putting ignore in big air quotes here, we can ignore race, right? If we live in segregated communities, if we are not interacting often, if the media that we consume, you know, is also lacking diversity, you can sort of get by it. But we're in a moment right now where, because of the pandemic, many of us are still home or sheltering in place to a certain extent. Our lives have been upended. And on top of that, we are dealing with a moment, a movement in this country for racial justice that will not be ignored. So what is this moment where we can't ignore race anymore due to these conversations, Jessica?
It allows not just the conversation, but it empowers it for me that this is a need that has been the elephant in the room far too long. And so by a lot of white families being able to live in this safety bubble and sort of look the other way and not have to deal with leaning into this discomfort, this movement has pushed it now to their front door, where you will not be able to look away and you will have to commit to something, whether that is committing to doing the work, whether that's the self-work on figuring out what biases that you have, how you may not have been taught to think about race, and allow yourself the space to develop these muscles so you can go forward making sure that you are modeling and teaching inclusion, especially talking about race with your kid. It's forcing you to sort of make that decision. Am I going to draw the line in the sand and say that I'm still going to continuously be colorblind and have this myth that we live in a post-racial society, or am I going to actually do the work to make sure that I just don't hope for the best for my kids, or say that, you know, I want the next generation to be better? Yet you're reeling that I've heard from a lot of parents, like, I thought this was, you know, in the 60s. I can't believe this is happening again. Or will you actually commit to a future that we have not yet experienced together in being and doing anti-racist work?
That also, I think that also sort of begs I wouldn't say the question, but I think it also illuminates the fact that there's just been a lack of understanding of what Black communities and more extensively communities of color have dealt with in this country. For a lot of Black people and non-Black people of color, there's this, I think, recognition that this has been brewing for a while. For white families to say, oh, we didn't know that this was going to happen, or we're so surprised, doesn't that also indicate a lack of historical understanding, Jessica?
Oh, 100%. So cultural identity is important, right? It gives kids a sense of belonging. It helps self-esteem. And yet we don't embrace cultural identity in a cross-cultural way. We say that the cultural norm is whiteness. And I'm saying that in air quote, but this is the experience that is normal, and anything else is sort of others. And you know, we don't really embrace that. And you look at, to me, the pinnacle of that was Drew Brees, and the fact that a lot of times white people make these statements that are centered in the erasure of a shared history, of shared cultures. So I look at the fact that when kids see themselves in history, a lot of times in school, they only see themselves through slavery. A lot of times is when they meet themselves. So you're seeing like white achievements throughout the whole course of history, and yet you're never giving any context around colonization, the achievements that happen with Black history before even arriving to America. A lot of times you only see that there's one type of cowboy. You look at other cultures, a lot of times Asian Americans get a snippet around internment camp. And so you're sort of reinforcing this narrative that there's only whiteness that has built and sustained America, instead of showing that there are so many great achievements that made America what it was, shameful and affirming in a celebratory way of people that were able to achieve when they didn't have much to, or a lot of obstacles in the way. And so I feel like then you only celebrate, you designate these months that a lot of times for white parents, they only engage and only participate during these themed heritage months. And then they think that's it.
I would also say that they oftentimes the conversations around Black History Month, for example, Hispanic Heritage Month, they're often highlighting folks like Martin Luther King and sort of a more peaceful peaceful form of protest, if you will. And right now we're seeing quite something that's quite powerful happening around the country. Jessica, how did your own parents talk to you about race when you were growing up? Did they talk to you about race?
Sure. So I always tell people that I was raised by like ex-Black Panthers, right? So they were the first, their short story was they grew up during segregation. My dad was born in 46, my mom 49. They followed the Great Migration. They were the first in their family to go and to finish college. And they wanted to make sure that we had a sense of pride in school. My mom immediately was affected by the Dahl study that was the height during her time in school with Brown versus Board. And she was so scared that we wouldn't be proud of ourselves and we would only consume the negative and the images portrayed in the media and the biases. So they a lot of times were not graceful, as I say, with introducing us to race. I always talk about like my dad at 9 was like, we have to watch Amistad. Like this is this is your history. And I just remember being super traumatized, being like, that's so intense.
Right. it's a lot. It's so, a lot for 9. Yeah.
and so that's how that's just how my parents treated race. They were just in your face. Like, I don't want you to be surprised when kids don't want to play with you or don't want to go to your birthday party or say that you live in a bad neighborhood.
So I want to bring that up to Bridget also, because I think what we're talking about here, and Jessica, to your point, this idea that Black children in this country are, you seem to have a sense of humor about it, but I mean, there really is a difference in how Black children are made aware, whether they want to be made aware or not, of the dangers of being Black in this country. At a very young age. And we've often talked about the talk, right? The talk that mm-hmm. Black parents have with their Black children, particularly if they're Black men, Black boys. And white children seem to be able to escape that for quite some time. And so, Bridget, I'm wondering if you can help us understand what effect that has, right? And the fact that Black children are hyper aware of race and the fear that surrounds that. And white children are often shielded from that until moments like now.
I think what it does is, for one thing, when children of color are made aware of this, it influences their self-esteem, their development, their identity. And for parents, it's especially Black parents, they do it in order to protect their children, that you have to be aware of this. And from very early on, they learn that they are being perceived based on their race. But then there's nobody talking about it. Like, they go to school, they're surrounded by teachers and white peers that don't have these conversations. And so it almost silences them. It trivializes their voices and their opportunity to express how they're feeling, almost as if they have to be ashamed of it, or that nobody cares or nobody knows. And so that affects them as well. So it's not just that you have white children growing up not being able to talk about this and maybe start developing biases because of everything they're exposed to in the media and the structural division that they see in society. It's also that the children of color are just overlooked and ignored, and that influences them in a negative way.
We're seeing, some of the news channels creating kids news channels, right, to really try to explain, here's a daily kids news report to kind of help children understand the moment that we're in. How effective, Jessica, are these forms of media? How well do you think an Elmo special on CNN, about racism, of all things, is received? And how effective is that?
I always say it's a start. A lot of times parents are open to figuring out how they can have age-appropriate conversations. I don't necessarily feel like it's a catch-all, or that you can go watch one special or you can experience some kids' news and then think that after a couple conversations, your kid will be on the path to whatever that looks like in doing and being an anti-racist. I feel that it's just the building blocks to start making these conversations and helping kids unpack traumatic events and not normalize it, but being sensitive and being able to make sure that you're touching base and connecting with that kid on what they're thinking, on their thoughts, and listening to them trying to figure out the world.
What can parents do? What are the resources outside of sitting down and watching the CNN Elmo special, for example? What should they be doing? Where are the resources? Is it books? Is it digital? Is it what is it, Jessica, in about a minute? And then, Bridget, I'll come to you.
Sure. I think books are the perfect place to start. A lot of times it takes the awkwardness out of putting the onus on the parent, and you can experience talking about sensitive topics through a character in the book. So whether that's sharing your feelings around how this person is experiencing the world, whether that's answering hard questions that your kid had, even saying that it's okay, saying that you don't have the answer, so maybe we need to think about it for a while. And then kids understand fair and unfair. So that's a totally appropriate age accessible way to make sure that you're connecting with them, that sometimes when Black people see a police officer, that scares them because they're treated unfairly. And then I would say, as far as looking at tragedy as a whole and Black trauma and pain, Fred Rogers always said, look for the helpers. So the people that are, you know, donating to bail bonds, the people that are, you know, helping protesters put milk or water in their eyes, that's great to highlight to the kids that in times of tragedy, look for the people that are out here being kind and compassionate and caring.
Yeah, I think the number one message is for parents to not be silent and to not wait for the kids to bring it up, because the conversation may never happen. I absolutely agree with Jessica that books are great conversation starters, especially for the younger kids. I think for older kids, you can start bringing in news stories, how the content is portrayed, what's happening. And most of all, ask children what they think. Because sometimes it takes kids a while just to even process what they're thinking and just to become aware of what they're thinking. So ask them what they think. And over time, when you start having these conversations, the children will learn that this is an okay topic to talk about, and they will start asking the questions, and you can start having those conversations. I do think one website that has great resources is the Embrace Race organization. They do have book recommendations. There's a lot of webinars for parents, both parents of color and white parents, that can really help parents start having these conversations.
So many things to consider and talk about. Bridget Vitrup is a professor of childhood development at Texas Women's University, and Jessica Bratt is the youth services manager at Grand Rapids Public Library. Thanks to you both for this really important conversation.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing.
Or politics.
Country music.
Hockey.
Sex. Of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.